to
hold on.
Yeah, you've been... App Store Connect before the show started, and it's been hanging all day in this waiting for App Store Connect SPI analysis response.
Oh, yeah,
taking
yeah.
forever mm-hmm. today.
So App Store Connect works kind of like a bad toilet. Sometimes it'll just get clogged up with a build, and usually if a build is stuck, usually it will never get unstuck. And the only way to unclog is to set another build down after it, just like the bug reporting system.
You just saying that made it get unstuck, so now I can quit.
Ah, I threatened it.
God, I spent indeed. All day fighting with the stupid Monterey bug. I forget now that I'm running Ventura that how much SwiftUI stuff is broken in Monterey. It's mm-hmm. so bad. I write this code. I'm like, why is this in here? And I'll just change it and make it more sane or whatever. And then I send it a test flight, and the Monterey people are like, oh, nothing works anymore. I'm like, oh, yeah.
No, I mean, because you have a SwiftUI app, you have absolutely no chance of supporting older operating systems. Like, that's because SwiftUI, yep. especially on the Mac, I mean, no chance.
Monterey was my thing. I had to boost the minimum version to Monterey so I could get anything to work. But now Monterey, the one I boosted it to, is the version where nothing works. So bad. So I'm not going to cut off support for it, but next year, man, definitely.
No, SwiftUI means the most recent OS and maybe one back. And that's it.
Yeah, I agree. Like, I personally would cut off Monterey soon, if not already. But that's just me.
I'll tell you one thing. I tried programming my app on the plane to and from California. Now, in past years, this has been a very productive time. This year, I was writing SwiftUI, and I couldn't get the Wi-Fi to work. And try to write SwiftUI without being able to Google things. I challenge you. It's impossible. Like today, I was writing SwiftUI all day today, and I have so many browser tabs. Like, I'm probably competing with John for browser tabs. Like, my computer is littered with browser tabs. Like, thank God I'm not doing this in Vision OS, because they would just be like filling the sky with they're everywhere. Every single thing I have to do. How do you do this?
What are you looking up in SwiftUI? I don't find that to be the case at all. I find that I can quickly look at the autocomplete and realize I can't do what I want. I don't have to Google
Usually
for it.
Usually it's more like technique stuff. It's like, all right, I have, like, I'm using the list thing to make a table view, and I want certain cells to not show their separators or whatever. It's like, it's stuff like that. Or like, how do I make the cell not, you know, how do I change the highlight color? It's stuff like that.
Yeah, you're talking about, SwiftUI on the phone where you actually have features. Yeah, I don't have that problem over here.
Like,
The things that I would be looking for in SwiftUI, I don't even have a chance Googling. The AI agents can't help me, because it's like, what I want, the interactions that I want are spread over so many different modifiers. Like, there's the modifier for drag, there's the modifier for drop, there's the modifier for hover. And they conflict with each other, and sometimes one works and the other doesn't, and all of them don't have any idea that the other ones exist. So you have to have all these state variables that you're setting. Like, hey, when we're hovering, set this thing. But if you're in the middle of the drag, the hover thing won't be called, so set this thing. But then there's a gesture recognizer for a zero length drag, which is a tap thing. And when that gets set, set this thing. And they have no idea about each other. It's like 8,000 state variables. And there's this conditional logic with a custom binding to say, okay, when the hover thing says you're on it, but the frame thing doesn't know you're in it because it stops tracking that as soon as you start to drag. But if you're in the middle of a drag and the drag thing says you're in the middle of the drag, but you haven't yet dropped, but you're holding down the button, it's like, oh my God.
That does
just
sound
please. It just coalesces into one thing that lets me know, is the mouse over it? Are there any buttons down? Is it holding something? Is it? Oh, it's just, it, you know, and so that giant mess of global variable, what am I going to Google for? Oh, hey, is there a way I can use, because you can Google for, how do I tell when the cursor's over it? How do I tell when the mouse is down? How do I tell when I'm dragging? How do I tell when I'm dropping? But those are all separate things. What if I want to do them all at the same time? And it's like, just have 75 modifiers and use 20 different state variables. And by the way, from OS to OS, you'll never know which modifiers are active and which aren't. Sometimes one completely cancels out the other and it stops getting called, or vice versa. So you have to manually call it, but don't try to modify a state variable inside the reader on SwiftUI, because you get a scary warning.
I will say, I am so glad I'm not doing SwiftUI on the Mac, because I tried. I very much tried. And as I've been rebuilding all of Overcast and all my frameworks below it, I've had all the ifdefs. You know, all the if OS, or, you know, if can import UI kit, then use UI color, UI image, else if can import, mm-hmm. you know, NS or app kit, use NS color. And I'm doing all that crap. And it's been taken forever. And because the APIs are needlessly different and in weird, subtle little ways that like require all this, you know, glue code. And as soon, the reason I was doing this was, first I thought, all right, well, if it's easy to do this, I'll do it. Because I'm using Swift UI, so I figured I can actually eventually build a native Mac UI for my app if I wanted to. And I figured it'd be a little bit of work to tweak it, you know, but here, you know, but I figured it wouldn't be that much work. But I was also thinking, you know, the headset was rumored for so long, and I was like, if the headset doesn't use UIKit at primitives as its like API layer, like UI image, UI color, UI font, all that stuff, if it doesn't use that, I want this stuff to all be modular, so I can actually easily plug in whatever it is, you know, VR image, VR font, whatever, you know, whatever they would have named that API layer. So when it was unveiled, and when we learned that it just uses UIKit primitives for everything, that means the only Apple platform that doesn't is the Mac. So I ripped out all of that code. Now I am UIKit everywhere, baby. It feels fantastic. There is so much glue that I could, because it was getting increasingly difficult to maintain it, honestly, and I haven't even made the app yet. And then I tried building the app in Swift UI, like while I still could, just natively on the Mac, to see like what is the Mac version of these controls look like. And I got it so nice on the iPad layout, so nice on the phone layout. I build the Mac layout. It looks like somebody vomited on my screen with random AppKit controls doing random things in random places, none of which were right.
Neat.
Everything about it was wrong and broken. And I'm like, okay, clearly, if I'm going to make a Mac app with this, with my Swift UI code base here, it's going to need its own like code, its own UI code from scratch almost. And so that's not worth it. So I'm just going to keep using the UIKit stuff on the Mac, you know, whether it's Catalyst or the, you know, iOS Mac environment for M1s. I'm just going to keep doing that. And then I can make everything UIKit everywhere else, which I promptly did. And everything is so much cleaner and easier. And there's so many little luxuries I'm able to use now. And like, oh man, it's so nice. I'm so glad. So that's point number one. Point number two, going back to the plane for 1 minute, because I wanted to remark on something that, you know, every so often, something in tech blows your mind. And last week we had one of those things, which is great. You know, so certain usually it's not that exciting. Usually, like the very first time I sent a print job to a printer over Wi-Fi, like when I was like on a laptop,
yeah.
And I hit print on my laptop, like on the couch, and then over there across the room, a piece of paper came out of a machine. Like that felt so magical to me. It was like, oh my God.
It's like when you're pooping and you can use your laptop and still browse the internet. That was earth shattering for me, I tell you what. You know, when Wi-Fi was in the house and you could bring your computer in and occupy your time. That was my bag right there.
I would love to make fun of you for that, but now we all do it with our phones, so what's the difference?
Yeah.
And so okay, so secondly, so I was on the plane with my broken Wi-Fi, but on one of the directions, the, quote, messaging-only free Wi-Fi from the airline worked. And I was able, you know, I'd never used the messaging-only before. I figured, like, what do I have to do? I'm not going to message people. I want to look up stuff on Google while I'm programming, you know? But what did work, I opened up Flighty on my phone to check, you know, halfway through the flight. I take in a nap. I woke up. I'm like, how far am I in this flight right now? And I'm like, oh, crap, I don't have data. I can't check. I open up Flighty to give an estimate, and it says it works on the free messaging only Wi-Fi on most airlines.
Yep.
And I was like, what? And I tried it, and sure enough, it worked. Now, I don't know how they negotiated this. I assume you have to like work with, you know, GoGo, InFlight, and whatever the airline things are to like approve your domain name or something.
That is not my understanding of how it works.
Well, however it works. Do you know how it works?
I do, but I'm not sure if it's appropriate for me to share. So maybe we can do a follow up.
Oh, okay.
Because Ryan will presumably hear this and then tell me, no, you idiot, you should have said something. But just in case.
I'd
rather not.
But that feature, it worked. It just, like, all of a sudden, I'm offline in every other way except, oh, my flight status just got updated. Now I can see where I am and everything. Oh my God, it blew my mind. I was so happy. So anyway, first of all, congratulations to Ryan and the rest of the Flighty team because mm-hmm. they won an ADA, and it's so well-deserved. The Apple Design Award, so well-deserved for that app. But it was just such a pleasure to use that app for my whole trip. I don't fly that much, but it was fantastic. So anyway, you know, thanks to Flighty. That's a really cool feature. And yeah, that's it for now. So anyway, next I request from Flighty To please be able to deliver me Swift UI Google results, so I can on my next flight, I can actually, you know, get some work done.
Something like that. Before we start with our with John's favorite episode of the entire year, we need to real time update. Ryan is listening live, so since I haven't quite left the topic, so my understanding from Ryan, having briefly spoken to him about this a few weeks ago, maybe a couple months ago. So what Flighty is doing is you can't use the full Flighty app. Like, I don't believe you can just go looking up willy-nilly like a random flight or whatever, but
no,
you are right.
Yeah, you get updates on your flight.
Exactly. How do you think those updates are coming to the phone, irrespective of where the phone is? Like, let's say you're watching my flight for some reason. You're going to come pick me up at, you know, JFK LaGuardia. You're watching my flight. How does that flight update get to your phone while you're on the ground?
All right, so I was assuming that they were pulling a web service every so often, but people in the chat, I think,
leave that aside.
Yeah, people in the chat, I think, have a better idea. They're saying, is it just using push notifications?
Yep. And so for the purposes, for iMessage, or for the airlines, iMessages and APNS, your Apple Push Notification Service or whatever, they look basically the same. So what Flighty is doing, and I'm not trying to dismiss isn't the word I'm looking for, but I'm not trying to minimize. There we go. I'm not trying to minimize what Flighty does, but what they're effectively doing is just periodically sending push notifications to your phone saying, this is where you are, this is where you are, this is where you are, this is where you are. And because that rides in a similar way to iMessage, if not, I mean, maybe iMessage literally uses APNS, I'm not sure. But that all rides in the same channels that iMessages do. So you can continue to get updates on your flight as you're airborne, because again, that's just, it looks like iMessages for the purposes of the airline Wi-Fi. It's extremely clever.
That's
it's very,
awesome.
Very clever. Yeah. So very good stuff. Anyway, so thank you, Ryan, for listening live and giving me the thumbs up on that. So we need to briefly recognize that not only did you have a lovely and wonderful week that I'm not at all jealous of in Cupertino in California last week, but you had a birthday this past Sunday. So happy birthday, Marco. I know it's belated, but happy birthday. I wanted to recognize it on the show. I've heard that I like a good occasion and anniversary, and so I am excited about the anniversary of your birth, sir.
Thank you very much. I am now older.
Indeed. All right, let's do John's favorite episode. It is all follow-up. I mean, should I just like go read a book or something? Do you need me for this, John?
There's plenty of follow-up for you to get through.
I see how it is. Do I need you then?
It's a team effort. We're going to do it together.
All right, let's hold hands. Jackson Ames writes, I noticed that every time a presenter during the WWDC 23 keynote said the word SIRI, it sounded off. It piqued my interest. And by the way, Jackson spelled it correctly, so kudos to Jackson. It piqued my interest, so I extracted the audio from the keynote and threw it into Adobe Audition. Lo and behold, every instance of the word SIRI, which I'm now afraid to say.
Come on, we'll say Siri. If they mess it up, okay. That's their fault.
All right. Every instance of the word Siri spoken during the keynote has certain frequencies practically muted. It looks like 400 hertz wide bands centered at the 3, 4, 5, and 6 kilohertz frequencies, all of which have the amplitude reduced by about 30 decibels. An interesting note is that this audio modification does not occur in previous Apple events. Now that the Siri wake phrase has dropped the hey, I wonder if this is a measure to avoid viewer Siri activation, giving a potentially less robust wake phrase. So maybe Marco can make the image, the chapter art for the chapter. But to paint you a brief word picture, imagine, you know, like a heat mappy sort of thing. Marco, jump in whenever you're ready. It, like a heat map sort of thing where it seems like the vertical axis is the one that matters. And yet suddenly you've got these like blank rectangles, four blank rectangles going horizontally through these waves. And that obviously is where the deadening of these frequencies has occurred. It's really quite striking to see, and a very interesting catch by Jackson. I did not notice this at all.
Yeah, and it's actually, so my guess, the reason they would do something like this is that, you know, the whatever algorithms they're using to recognize the word Siri, I'm guessing if you have a couple of gaps in the frequency range, which is what this is creating, then it will not detect it. Now, I don't know. I think we talked about it when this happened, but a few years ago, there was an Alexa event where they had the same thing where, or maybe it was a TV commercial.
Yeah.
It was a TV commercial.
I know what you're thinking of.
Yeah. There was some kind of TV commercial or something, I believe, where somebody in the commercial had to say Alexa. And to prevent that from being recognized by everyone's Amazon Echoes all over their houses when this TV commercial played, they did a similar trick where they basically lopped off part of the frequencies of that speech. And so it sounded a little bit weird, but not too weird that most people would, like, you know, find it, you know, problematic. And it defeated the algorithm enough. And I actually, the reason why I remember this is that I thought for a brief time when that happened, I thought, can I reproduce this myself in Overcast? And can I possibly either offer a filter that would prevent recognition of these wake words in case somebody's listening to a podcast that's talking all about voice assistants and is tired of, you know, them responding? Or even better, can I, like, analyze the audio myself? If these wake words are really that easy to identify in processing, can I do the processing ahead of time? And anytime somebody says Alexa or Siri, just mute those frequencies so that my podcast player never sets off people's stuff. And at the time, I was not able to reproduce this in a way that worked against my own Alexa devices. But I never tried it with Siri. So now that I have this kind of frequency map of, like, if I do this, it presumably won't be recognized. Now I have something else to experiment with. So this is a stupid feature. I probably won't do it, but it's a fun thing to play around with. And it's a fun thing to know, like, if you need to somehow make Siri not be recognized with an audio recording, this is a way that probably works to do it.
A couple things on this. First, what's the name of this thing? It's like, there's a name for this kind of diagram, Marco. Do you know it? Like frequency spectrograph or something?
Yeah, basically. So the x-axis is time, and the y-axis is a logarithmic frequency display. So normally when you see a waveform, like in an audio editor, you see, like, the up and down, you know, the actual, like, samples forming waves.
The amplitude, yeah.
Yes. This is showing you the different frequency breakdowns of each chunk of time as it goes. So this is generally easier and more illustrative of how something actually sounds.
Right. And so this is a great example of a visualization that, like, you know, when you heard this in the keynote, I bet a lot of people didn't think that Siri sounded weird at all. Didn't sound weird to me. Right. But when you see it in this type of diagram where, you know, like I said, time along the x-axis and frequency spectrum along the y, it's clear as day. Like, it's clear as day that something's happened, and B, it's clear that whatever happened was artificial, right? This is not a natural phenomenon. It is rectangles just chunked out of the frequency spectrum. It's just a great example of how visualization can help you find something that another view on the same data wouldn't. And second thing is, I think we forgot to mention last week the feature that Apple touted in the keynote of that you don't have to say, hey, dingus anymore. You can just say dingus. But I believe there's also a setting. I haven't actually installed the iOS 17 betas, but I believe there's a setting where you can say, no, please make me say hey. Do either one of you have the iOS 17 betas installed and can confirm that?
I will double check that in a moment. Hold on.
Because I think if that option exists, I think I'm going to put the hey back on, because I have enough problems with accidental activations with the word hey in front of it. I don't need any more.
Yes. So under Siri and Search, there's now an option called listen for. And your choices are off, so it won't listen for any wake phrase. Or you can say, hey, Siri, or you can say, Siri or hey, Siri. So I hopefully that didn't set anybody's stuff off.
Did you notice that, like, I don't have any problem saying Siri, but the actual wake phrase of the free iOS 17 devices, I don't know what we're going to do once iOS 17 comes out. Your devices better get ready.
I mean, maybe they have made the recognition more sophisticated, and that's what has enabled them to drop this. Because, like, I don't know if you remember when... I believe when they, either a year after or something, like sometime early on when Phil Schiller was on the talk show live, he said, hey, dingus, right during the show, and no one's phone in the audience went off. Now, first of all, you know he thought about that first. Second of all, you know that he was confident nothing bad would happen, because then later on he mentioned that. He like referred to it. He's like, look, like, you know, I just said that and no one, like, he somehow, I forget exactly, but he somehow referred back to it. So we all knew that he was in on what he just did. And that's a pretty, you know, that was a pretty confident move, I think. Maybe I would say maybe it took courage. So for Apple to be doing this, to have dropped the hey requirement and therefore having made the wake phrase even simpler and less distinct from arbitrary sound, I would assume that comes with an improvement in sophistication. And I think one thing that kind of might lend credence to this is that not all devices have that. And I have to double check. I believe I saw something today that said that AirPods Max will not get the Siri-only wake phrase, but AirPods Pro, the newest AirPods Pro, will. So it seems like, you know, my guess is there's more advanced computation happening and like only on the most recent devices and software versions.
All right. There's plenty to talk about with regard to Vision Pro. And we start with Apple's 10-minute standalone promo video, which I watched earlier today. It's pretty good. I enjoyed it. I mean, it's a lot of what we saw in the keynote, to be honest with you, almost entirely, I think, but it's pretty, pretty good.
Yeah, if you just want to watch one thing, you don't want to watch the whole keynote, it's a good thing to check out. We'll put a link in the notes.
Indeed. And also, Steve Trout and Smith, amongst others, have noticed that there are plenty of references to XROS in the WWD or the Apple developer app, you know, that which is where you watch like WWDC sessions and stuff like that. Lots of occurrences of XROS. Also, it might have been one of you two, probably John, but somebody pointed out that you can tell that they filmed this filmed a lot of the sessions a while ago, because there are many references to, quote, Apple's spatial computing platform, quote, rather than Vision Pro, which I noticed, but I think I thought about it at the time and then promptly didn't think much of it after that. But that is pretty funny to me that they didn't even have the marketing name locked down when they were recording these dub videos. So
yeah, oh, no, I think it was locked down. It was not disclosed. I think that's the real answer.
Well, so the people who are making the apps like Xcode, you know, they showed in the demos, you just select this is your target or this is your OS, and the UI in Xcode had to have a name, but it didn't have Vision OS. It had XROS everywhere. So there was buttons with XROS on them, tabs with XROS. It was just everywhere. And this is setting aside, as we know, the symbols in the code, which are called Reality OS and XROS. So anyway, yeah, this is this big symbol cleanup, which I assume they're going to do. I assume they're going to go through and clean up all. Obviously, they'll clean them up in the UI. I do wonder if they're going to clean them up in the source, but I imagine they would, because you don't want to be stuck with like some kind of enum being Reality OS for the next 20 years. Just change it now to Vision OS.
Yeah, especially now that everything's still in beta, like it's super easy to change it now. But I mean, yep. I think, so first of all, you know, the reason why is very clear. Like, you know, we heard, I believe they even said during Talk Show Live, like the marketing department did not tell the name of the product and the OS to almost anybody until almost the last minute. Like it was so secret, even from within the company, that many departments of the company didn't even know the final marketing name of the product or the OS.
Like, including the guy in charge of the headset, Mike Rockwell, said he found that on Monday when we did watching the video. When we talk about compartmentalization at Apple, why would the guy in charge of the headset not know what it's called? Because he doesn't have to. Right. That's the answer. That's what compartmental. Does he need to know the marketing name to get his job done? No, he does not.
and you know, this product I've been trying to figure out, like, when did they start this product? Like, when did they start this project? And as far as I've been able to pick up bits and pieces here and there, other people probably have better information than I do on this. But my best guess right now is at least 6 to 7 years ago.
There was a Mastodon thread that flew by, and somebody who formerly worked on it. I'll see if I can find a link for the show notes.
It's already in there.
Is it?
Yeah, okay. I think I might have put it in the notes. But it was the guy who said he like worked on it 5 years ago, and he just spilled a bunch of beans. We do have something in the notes from somebody who was involved in what would seem like kind of like a, you know, in the home stretch development of it that was before COVID-19 or just when, you know, in 2019, just when that started happening. This project, we've been hearing about this project for years and years and years. So I'm sure 6 or 7 years is conservative.
Yeah. And all that time, they were writing probably a ton of software for this. And so all that time, they had to refer to it as something in the code. And so all over the code, I'm sure there's XROS all over the place.
And Reality OS, which is another name that's floating around in the code.
I didn't see Reality OS, but there was like a UI interface idiom dot reality as an enum, as an enum value.
Yep.
Either way, you know, obviously they had to call it something. And I think it's an amazing feat of marketing that the name didn't leak. That we had all these other leaks. There were not a ton of surprises about this device when it came out, but the name did not leak at all. And that obviously took a lot of secrecy, with the name only being known to a very small number of people before we all learned it. But that is pretty impressive.
Yep, very much so. All right, John, tell me about the fit of the Vision Pro, please.
Despite the fact that none of us actually got to try this, which is very disappointing. Only one of us got to go to WWC, which was Marco, and Marco didn't get to try it despite his best efforts. He really, really tried, but there's a limited number of slots, and, you know, what can you do? But anyway,
I even offered to move my flight back. I'm like, look, I'll change my flight if I can get a later appointment, whatever it takes. But it was not enough.
Yeah, limited slots. So we do what we could. But anyway, lots of other people have tried it and they've reported back. And so here are some of the sort of an amalgam of the report. So the first is that there is the people who did the demo, there was a fitting thing where you scanned your face with, you know, an IR type scanner or whatever, kind of like you do for FaceTime, where it gets a depth map of your face. And I think they believe they use an iPhone to do it. You also scan your ear, which is a thing you can do now with your iPhone and iOS 16. I forget when they rolled that out, but it wants you to scan your ear shape to get your head related transfer function. See previous episodes of this program where we talked about that. So you do those things. You scan your ear and you scan your face. In response to the face scan, they're picking from one of the light shield things that smushes against your face that they have available to find the one that fits you. They also took glasses from people who had glasses and measured them to see what the people's prescription was, and then came out with these little prescription things, which, by the way, we all just assume that these prescription lenses are going to cost like $500 to put in your thing. So, hey, this headset is $3,500, but if you wear glasses, it might be $4,000, we'll see.
Oh, I didn't even think about that.
Obviously, they didn't say anything about pricing, and they don't even haven't decided the stuff yet, right? But just FYI, this is a thing they did, so people could see the headset. So then, you know, they put the face thing on based on your face scan. The ear scan determines how they're going to do the spatial audio. So they put that in somewhere and they snap in the prescription lenses based on them scanning your eyeglasses for you. I imagine the experience will be similar for buying this thing. Either you go into an Apple store and they'll do all the same stuff to you in person. I'm not sure if they'll have the eyeglasses scanning machine. We'll see. If you do it online, you'd probably have to have an iPhone so you could scan your own face. And if you didn't have an iPhone, you'd probably have to go to an Apple store. And maybe they'll let you enter your prescription somewhere because you don't have an eyeglasses scanning machine home. But anyway, just to get an idea of what's involved in getting one of these, the purchase process is going to somehow involve all of these things, except for the ear thing. You can do that once you get it. But the things that affect the physical device, what lenses do you need to get to snap into them, and what kind of face thing do you get? In terms of the weight with this thing on people's faces, I was mentioning in the past show how the battery being external is a big deal because it keeps a weight off of the headset. But people have reported that this thing feels heavier than they thought it would. And most of the people who have tried it are blaming it on the fact that they use metal instead of plastic, because Apple loves to use metal because it's high quality and it's nice and it's durable. It's also heavier than plastic, right? They did it on the AirPods Max. Those ear cups are made of metal. They look real nice. They're very durable, but they're heavier than if they were made of plastic.
Glass, too. So, the whole front thing, I believe, is glass.
Yeah, although glass, they kind of have to do for optical qualities. If they made that plastic, it would be like, you know, the iPod Nano all scuffed up and everything, right? So I kind of don't blame them for that, but yeah, it's metal. Mike Hurley on Cortex called it the AirPods Max of VR devices, referencing the fact that the AirPods Max have the metal ear cups and it makes them heavy. And Mike said the Vision Pro felt heavier on the front of his face than a Meta Quest Pro, which is plastic. So I think it is, in general, lightweight, especially considering all the stuff that's in it. But Apple can't stay away from that aluminum. They love it. And, you know, I understand why they'd want to go with the metal frame. There are so many advantages, but weight is an issue. They didn't say it was super duper heavy. It's just that it was heavier than they thought it would be. And it was heavier than, you know, Mike said it was heavier than the Meta Quest Pro, which is a headset that he has experience with, that obviously is not as good and doesn't have good specs, but whatever. So there's that.
Well, weight, by the way, like in terms of comfort with, you know, comparing it to headphones, the way that headphones distribute weight on your head is extremely different from where the weight and how the weight is distributed with a VR headset. So it's not a good direct, like, I feel like it doesn't matter as much if the weight is spread correctly. So when you think about, like, with headphones, all the weight is being held either by, like, the middle of the top of your head where the strap touches, where, you know, where the big, you know, headband thing touches the top of your head. And then the rest of the force is the ear cups pushing against your ears, like sideways, plus a bit of gravity pushing down that hits the ear pads. And that's a little bit different with those, too, because that's also how they stay on your head. So headphones have to kind of clamp a little bit from the sides just so they don't fall off or move around. So if you look at the way a VR headset's mounted on your head, that entire strap that goes around, and we'll get to this in a second, there's also apparently an optional top strap. But this, that it, when you look at how, like, where the weight's resting on your head, it's spread over a much larger area than headphones spread it. So it might be okay. Like, I have a pair of headphones here, my beloved Hi-Fi Man HG6 headphones. These are my soul headphones. I have those. Those weigh significantly more, I think. I'll double check. I think they weigh much more than the AirPods Max, because they have, you know, this giant, like, you know, magnet assembly inside each ear cup. It's a huge thing. Anyway, They're fairly heavy as headphones go, but they're designed to spread that weight around in a much larger area and with much better padding than the AirPods Max. And so I can wear those for hours. In fact, I wore them most of today, and it's fine. Whereas the AirPods Max just kind of don't. I find them very uncomfortable after a pretty short time, just because they're designed to apply pressure differently and spread the weight differently. So weight itself, like, you can have a heavy headset and also have it be comfortable over multi-hour use. It just depends on the other factors of its design, how the headbands are shaped, how the eye seal is shaped, like all that stuff. Where is the weight? How is the weight distributed? How does it move around? Does it have to like clamp down very hard, or is it more just kind of resting there? And I fully expect that almost everybody will get that top head strap, because that should improve all of that substantially.
Yeah, Mike mentioned that felt heavier on the front of his face, and I think that's for two reasons. First, where the weight is depends on a lot. Headphone weight is on the side by your ears. There's no headphone weight that's hanging out past your nose. This thing is obviously hanging out past your nose, right? And second is, you're moving your head around, I imagine, unless that depends on you're bopping with the music. But when you're using this thing, you're looking around, right? And as you look around, the heaviest part of this is extending out from your head, so it's swinging at the end of a lever as you move your head around. So whatever weight they put that is extended out past the front of your eyeballs, that weight is multiplied by its distance from like sort of the pivot point of your head moving around. So that's why he said it felt heavier on the front of his face, and plus it's maybe resting your nose. And yeah, there is a top strap. You can see it in the WWDC keynote briefly in that scene where the guy's the dad's taking a video, 3D video of the birthday party. He's got the top strap on. I didn't notice that when we talked about it on Monday after the keynote, and I was saying how they had managed to do it without a top strap. It was just a straight back strap with that big sort of like cup thing that's cupping the back of your head, which I would imagine would also help carry the weight, because it doesn't just like press in one spot. It kind of wraps around and it goes up and down. But apparently the top strap is there as it was used during the press demos. I think everybody who did a press demo had the top strap, and people were told during the press demos that the strap situation is not yet finalized. That's a paraphrase of what the Apple people said. So Apple's not committing one way or the other about what the deal is going to be with straps. Apple did say that they expect third-party straps to exist, because if you've seen the little exploded diagram, the Vision Pro is modular. So there's the actual thing with the computer stuff in it. Then there's the light shield thing, which shoves against your face. Then out of the light shield, out of the headset and the light shield, there are these two little stiff little sticks. And then the straps attach to that. And so Apple's own straps, the one that goes in the back of your head, attaches to that. And Apple's own top strap attaches to that, right? And third-party straps will also attach to that. And Apple expects there to be third-party straps. So that's important in terms of like getting something that fits your head right. Kind of like even just like the tips on AirPods Pro, right? If you don't like the Apple tips, you can buy third-party tips, see if you find something that works for you. So that's all, I think, mostly good news. But it is interesting that Apple hasn't quite yet figured out what the deal is going to be with straps. And if you look at the top strap, it does not look as well integrated as the main strap. It looks kind of like an afterthought, and it doesn't, but anyway, again, the strap situation is not finalized, so more to come on that. Yeah, speaking of the physical reality of the headset, we talked about the power cable and like what happens if the power cable comes out, your thing just shuts down. Well, the people who used it in real life have told us that the power cable does not easily detach. It is not like MagSafe, where it's just like, oh, it snicks on there with the magnet. It actually kind of like mechanically locks into place. So you would have to do something to get it out. So that's good to hear.
Yeah, like I wasn't concerned about accidental removal of it. I was concerned about, like, well, if you were using the battery pack and for some reason, if you wanted a second battery pack so you can run 4 hours, you can't really, like, hot swap it.
Yeah, although now that I know that it doesn't pop off like MagSafe, now I'm concerned about cord yanking situations, you know what I mean? Like a kid runs by, or you get overexcited, or you're walking somewhere and don't notice that it snags on something. I guess the battery would just come out of your pocket then, but we'll see how that gets worked out.
To go back a half step, if you haven't listened to Cortex, this latest episode, we'll put a link in the show notes. It is very, very good. And pretty much the whole episode is Mike and Gray talking about the Vision Pro and Mike's experience with the Vision Pro. It is like an hour and a quarter long or something like that. So it's a lot, but it is probably
compared to our show.
It's nothing compared to us. What I need to say is it is a lot for a single topic. And and that being said, it is incredibly in depth and far and away the most I don't know, like full coverage of the Vision Pro that I have seen, heard, or read.
I think it's good if you wanted to hear like what it was like to go to be press and to be led through the demo. That's what it is, a retelling of the experience of doing the demo as much as it is of talking about the device.
Also true. Yeah. So we talked about the top strap, the power cord. There is apparently a guest mode. Tell me more about this.
You skipped. You got to pay attention to that. Yeah.
Oh, damn it. I missed power use. Hi, future Marco. All right. Goodbye, future Marco.
You can't get with anything with John.
Nope. This is his favorite episode. He lives for this. It's nothing but follow up. It's follow up all the way down. All right. So we know about the power cable, but how much electricity is the cable providing, John?
There's still some debate about this, but we had one listener, Hughes84, offer this. It's pretty simple to estimate the power draw from the battery size. It looks to be about 10,000 to 15,000 milliamp hour battery, which are 3.7 volt cells. So it's 37 to 55 watt hours. With a 2.5 hour runtime, that's 15 to 22 watt average power draw, quite low for the hardware and processing. And we have heard some people discussing the Vision Pro may come with a 30 watt power brick. So the watt range is like, you know, under 50 watts for sure, maybe 15 to 20. If it comes with a 30 watt brick, that should be enough. So if you're wondering how much power the sucker draw, that's what it does. And it kind of makes sense if you know what's in it. I mean, we know there's an M2 in it, and we kind of have an idea what that draws. We know that the R1, if you just assume that draws the same power as the M2, now you've got to double the M2 plus the screens, 30 watts, somewhere in that range. Sounds reasonable, but not like 90 or 100 watts. And of course, it does have one or more fans inside it to cool it. It would be nice if there were some fans blowing cool air into the possibly sweaty area where your eyeballs are. But as far as I know, the singular or plural fans, I imagine there's two, one for each side, are there to cool the electronics, not your face.
Yeah, it does seem like, I forget where I heard this or how authoritative it was, but I got a pretty solid response from somebody saying, yeah, it's 30 watts. Like, that's it. It's a 30 watt cap. A 30 watt power supply will power continuously. So that's the answer.
All right, so there's more good news. There is apparently going to be a guest mode, and I'm not entirely sure how that's going to work, but I'm happy to hear it because, my word, it's not like I'm going to buy one of these per person in the house or anything like that. So tell me more about this, John.
This was official statements from Apple to iMore. This is from the article that we'll link. It says Apple plans to share more information about guest mode closer to the launch of the headset. While details are scant about what guest mode for Vision Pro will entail, it seems likely this will let users share the headset among friends, family, and other users. And they did talk about the retina scanning thing where it determines who you are by scanning your eyeball or whatever. I don't think it's retina scanning, whatever it does. Here's the question, though. I just got done explaining all the stuff of like how it scans your face and your ear and you pick the thing and you get the prescription lenses. What are the odds that someone else is going to be able to fit into your face thing with your prescription lenses? And, you know, are they going to have to scan their ear? Are they going to bring their own little lenses with them? For a 2 second thing, yeah, the face thing won't fit on quite right and it'll have light leakage and it'll be a little bit uncomfortable. And incidentally, a lot of the people who did the press demo said of the choices of sort of face squishy thingies they had there, light shield things, they didn't have that many choices, and the sort of best fit one wasn't that great of a fit on them. Presumably, there will be more choices as the product gets closer to launch.
There will be more, according to people I spoke with. That what they had here was a very small subset of the total number that will be available at retail.
Yeah, so it'll be unlike the watch straps, which come in what, two sizes, right? The small, right? There'll be many more sizes than that because there's just much more variability in people's faces. So there's that, and guest mode flies in the face of that because guest mode presumes that anyone will actually be able to use your headset. I do wonder if you get it with prescription lenses, does it come with the non-prescription ones, or do you just get the prescription ones, in which case no one will be able to use it unless they have the same prescription as you.
I thought the lenses were like snap-in magnetically attached additive things. I didn't think it was
I don't know if there's some like, you know, the non-prescription lenses are also lenses, or is just the lack of lenses. Is it adding an element to the thing, or is it like replacing an element that was there?
I thought the prescription stuff was additive. I don't know that for certainty, of course, but I thought it was additive.
Well, I wouldn't rely too much on this guest mode being like a practical thing. What I'm guessing this is, you know, it's not going to be like someone else in your house can have their own apps installed. It's probably going to be more like, let me show you something, and you can show someone else what you're looking at briefly. You know, oh, here, check this out, and you pass the headset to them. They stick it on for a minute and look at the thing you're seeing, and then give it back to you. Like, I don't think it's going to be like anything approaching a multi-user environment.
It should be, though. Like, honestly, at this point, them making a new platform that's not multi-user. I just got done saying this is like the hardest platform to make multi-user in terms of the hardware, because it has to literally fit on people's faces. But software wise and like CPU power wise and memory, the rumor is this has 16 gigs of RAM or something. And it's got like, there's room for multiple accounts, man. Like, just make it happen. I know it's going to be weird because it's, you know, like, shouldn't they come to the iPad first? Like, I hear that, but this is a brand new platform. Is it because it's derived from, you know, iOS and iPadOS that adding multi-user is a pain in people's butt? But yeah, guest mode is probably just like a little playpen where they can't screw with your stuff, but they can try out your cool headset, even though it won't exactly fit them that well.
Yeah, like maybe to like stay locked in whatever app you're currently in, or something like that. Meaning,
or, you know, it'll go to like a, you know, like a guest mode where it's just like, you know, they reboot the user space into a thing that is not signed into any Apple IDs and just has access to like Safari and some apps or something. Who knows? We'll see.
No, I'm guessing it's more like it's like a toggling control center that you like you flip to temporarily lock yourself, you know, kind of like guided access, like lock yourself into one app so you can show someone, hey, look at this, yeah. And then it won't scan their iris when you take it off and give it to them. You know, it's probably that kind of thing. But yeah, honestly, I don't think there's any chance of this becoming a multi-user device because of all the physical challenges of that. You know, because it so relies on scanning your face, scanning your ears, getting the right eye light shield piece.
And presumably you only get one. It's not like you get the whole set of light shields. Right. You get the one that fits you. You don't get 17 of them. I mean, you could buy extras, I imagine, and buy extra straps, and then you have to adjust the straps. Like, it's a real barrier to sharing, for sure.
Oh, yeah. Like, already today, like, you know whenever my son wants to buy some new content in the Facebook Quest, whatever, he has to pass me the headset so I can, like, enter the PIN inside the headset. And this just destroys his setup. Like, just taking it off and having it go onto my head. Like, the straps get all messed up, and I try to leave it as much as I can, but, like, you know, still, the straps get stretched out, and everything's all wrong, and then, you know, it's like, it's terrible. These devices, you know, one of the big challenges to their adoption and their spread in the world is you can't just pass it to someone else and have them experience things the way you are. You know, there's like video pass through modes where you can like show what you're seeing on a nearby computer screen or something. There's that kind of thing. But to actually show someone else what it's like in 3D space is just a very difficult physical problem to solve. And so I don't expect any kind of multi-user support to really ever be a thing on these headsets. And unlike John, I totally see why they didn't do it, because there's basically no way to do it well.
No, well, here's the thing. This is a legacy of tech debt from the original iPhone. This tech debt had to be incurred in the original iPhone because it was on the ragged edge of what was possible with the hardware at the time. So everything they did, things running as root, single user, no swap, like all that makes perfect sense in 2007. But that time has marched on. That tech debt has just been accruing and accruing. And now they're making a brand new platform, which by all rights should have multiple users support at the OS level in case they ever want to do it. But that same tech that is carried over from iOS to iPadOS all the way up to, you know, it's like Unix is a multi-user operating system. And granted, I know why they did it for the iPhone. They just never dug back out of that tech debt. For the phone, it probably is like the phone, I think, makes the least amount of sense. It's not like you're going to share your phone with people, right? For the iPad, it makes way more sense because iPads are shared among families. For this, we just described all the reasons it doesn't make sense, but it's a brand new platform. Like, you know, you got to get out of that tech debt someday. Even if you don't roll out that feature until version 7 of this product, like, dig out of it eventually, please. I feel bad about it.
I don't know. I feel like these devices will not be true to form multi-user, but I would not be at all surprised if when you put one of these on, if you don't pass the retina scan, and I know it's not literally a retina scan, but for, you know, the purposes of discussion, if you don't pass the retina scan.
Well, they said an iris scan. I suppose that's slightly different, but
it's a different part of your eye.
Yeah, but it's still an eye scan.
The front instead of the back.
Yeah, right.
Right. I mean, it ultimately doesn't matter. Once you fail an eye scan and it's clear that this is not the primary user of the device, I would assume that they would drop you into kind of a vanilla, like, oh, this device has never been used before kind of setup, where you don't have any custom apps installed. You just get the out of the box apps. I thought there was something like this in the context of school or education for iPad. I thought they had something similar.
Yeah,
to this.
No, they have a terrible hack for it. That's where they like reboot the user space and do all sorts of other things. It used to be worse, where they would like re-image the thing, but now they just reboot the user space. But like, again, the straightforward way to do multiple users is how macOS does it. Like literal actual multiple users, like they be logged in at the same time, they'd be on separate Apple IDs, they are their own completely separate thing. It's that just it came with the operating system they bought from Next, and they had to set it aside for the iPhone due to the constraints of 2007 phone hardware, right? And they've just never dug back out from it. It's just it is rippling through their platforms. The only in the one case, the Mac platform is the only one not burdened by this particular technical debt. Mac has tons of other technical debt, but this particular one the Mac does not have.
I mean, in all fairness, Mac multi-user stuff does occasionally cause some bugs, John. Like,
John?
It's not the fault of the multi-user thing. It's the fault of the Windows server.
In any case, what I'm trying to say is if you fail your eye test when you put on the headset, I wouldn't be surprised if it says, hey, do you want to use this as a guest? And it might even go so far as to say, all right, you need to do the whole scan thing, which I understand takes a few minutes or if from everything I've heard from like Mike and others. But I think it would be such a powerful marketing tool for me to go to Marco's house and say, all right, let me try this stupid Vision Pro thing. And, yes, I have to spend like 4 or 5 minutes, whatever it is, doing my scans and this and that. But then if you're to believe literally everyone who's tried it, within 30 seconds of putting it on, I'm going to be asking Marco if he can look the other way while I run away with his Vision Pro. So I wouldn't be surprised if it's more robust than I think, Marco, you're giving them credit for. And we'll see. I mean, who knows?
I wouldn't be surprised if it doesn't make it to the release.
That's also
Apple
fair.
Says they
That's
have more information to share as we get closer to launch. This totally looks like a feature that gets booted to a later revision.
Coming later this next year.
Later, exactly. I mean, it's, we'll see.
John, when you try to do semi-complicated math off the top of your head extemporaneously, turns out you can occasionally make a whoops. So
I didn't make a whoops. I knew I didn't know the math off the top of my head. So I just said, this is not really how it is, but, and I tried to give the optimistic scenario of how things are, but the real scenario is much worse than the optimistic, which I knew. I just didn't know the exact math. So I tried to hand wave it. But anyway, here's the exact math. Talking about pixels and eyeballs, right? So 4K television resolution is roughly 8.3 million pixels. 8K is not twice as many pixels as 4K. 8K is four times as many pixels as 4K. So it's like four 4K monos. I didn't know if it was exactly four times because these TV standards of resolutions, they're not like, if you're wondering what the 4K resolution is, you'd really think one of the numbers would be 4,000 something, but it's not. It's 2,160 by 3,840. That's 4K. So I didn't actually know if 8K was exactly 4X, but it's pretty much exactly 4X, right? So here's Apple Vision Pro. It has 23 million pixels, which is 11.5 million per eyeball. So 11.5 million per eyeball is higher than the 8.3 million, which would be a 4K. So it has more than 4K per eyeball, but the total number of 23 million is less than 8K across the two eyeballs. So there you have it. There's been a lot of people doing math on the more interesting thing than number of pixels, which is number of pixels per degree. If you think of like your degrees, how many degrees of vision, if you had 180 degree field of view, like it's how many pixels fit into like 1 degree of your field of view. And that's what kind of determines whether you can see the pixels and whether it's retina and so on and so forth. But the upshot from all the people who have seen this thing is that it's basically retina. Like nobody had any problems looking at text. Nobody said the text looked jaggy. Nobody said there was a screen door effect. Like it passes muster as you can look at text on little rectangles floating in front of you and it looks crisp. So that's what's important. The thing about, can I use this to get a bigger screen than I have in real life? It depends on how close you pull it to yourself, which is another aspect of this. Like in your real life screen, you can actually move it across the desk real close to your eyeballs. But if you want to get more pixels of sort of resolution out of your virtual screens, you can literally move your head closer to them or pull the big floating rectangles closer to you. And now you are spending more pixels on the little, micro OLEDs that are inside there per unit of virtual screen area. So you could have a very, very large screen. You just wouldn't be able to see it all at the same time. So that's the flexibility this offers you. But yeah, like I don't want to get too bogged down into the details of this, except to say that like, is this a way for you to get a bigger monitor than you have now? Depends on how big your monitor is. It's for a 6K monitor, it's not quite there, but it doesn't really matter if you can't see the pixels. Like I know macOS and iOS and whatever don't do non-integer scaling modes, although iOS does do 2X and 3X. But because of the way this works and because of the interaction between the pixels and the virtual screens and the distance from you, you are effectively changing the multiplier as you pull the virtual screen closer and farther from you. That's not true of a phone or an iPad or a Mac. You are not changing the multiplier that the OS draws at or the number of pixels you use to draw like a window control. You're not changing that by moving the screen closer and farther from you. You're not changing that by moving your face closer. When you move your face closer to your phone, your iPad, or your Mac screen, the pixels get bigger. When you move the virtual rectangle closer to you in Vision and Apple Vision Pro, pixels do not get bigger because the pixels are always exactly the same distance from your eyeball because they're inside a headset. So it is very different. And speaking of the screens, the refresh rate, according to Apple's WWDC sessions, is 90 hertz, but switching to 96 hertz for movies because 96 is evenly divisible by 24 frames per second, which most movies are shot at. I don't know. We don't know. Are those screens capable of 120? Are they capable of any arbitrary resolution? But Apple has at least confirmed it will do 90 hertz and 96 hertz.
Indeed.
By the way, to answer your earlier comment about, you know, depending on how big your monitor is, when I came home to my glorious 6K Apple Pro Display XDR after this trip, it has never looked small before until now. And now that I'm, like, imagining, like, wow, I have this whole wall in front of me, like, that could all be screen space. And now my giant monitor looks like, why am I looking in this tiny little window when I have this huge wall not doing anything?
Well, that's the other aspect of it. By making the screens inside the headset bigger, like having it be 20 feet, you don't get more pixels. It's always the same amount of pixels. But, you know, in the end, well, all that matters is, can you resolve those pixels? Like the number of pixels per degree, I think, was it like 70 or something? Most popular headsets are like 20. The really good gaming headsets are like in the same range as Apple Vision Pro. They're 60, 70 pixels per degree. But once you can't resolve them, it's fine, right? That's all you're looking for is, like, you know, I can't resolve them anymore. I don't actually care how many more pixels per degree it is. So we're maybe within one doubling of it being just like a non-issue from everybody. This is a version one product. Maybe people did say when they're looking around the room that people described it as looking at kind of grainy. Like, why does this not look like reality? Pretty much everybody who did the press thing said it's amazing. Transparency is amazing. It looks like you're just looking through the clear lenses, but they all said it's like you're looking through like a pair of goggles. Right. And that the world looks like not real, but like you're looking through something that's like a dirty pair of goggles, or that it looked grainy or whatever. And I think what they're seeing is not a lack of resolution, but mostly what we discussed before about HDR. Those screens can't match the dynamic range of the real world. And it's always going to look slightly different. You know, you're going to be able to tell, am I looking at a screen or am I looking at the real world? In situations where the real world has not a lot of dynamic range because of the lighting, it'll be harder to tell. But if you're in any situation with a reasonable amount of dynamic range because of light or sunlight or whatever, you're going to be able to tell the difference because the screens can't do that dynamic range, which is why we need to keep chasing that dynamic range stuff. Because if you want the Apple Vision Pro version 8 to be indistinguishable from looking at the world, you're going to need a more dynamic range from your little tiny HDR screens.
Neil O'Mara was one of many, many people to point out the following. Neil writes, isn't it odd that at the exact same time Apple launches an iPad or iOS warning that people are too near their screens to ward off myopia, that they launch a device that straps two HDR screens fractions of an inch away from your eyes? It's a good illustration that they are successful and big enough such that one arm of the company doesn't have a clue what the other is doing. But it's surprising it got through their keynote quality check. Hey, who needs consistent messaging anyhow?
I don't think it's actually inconsistent, and here's why. The whole myopia thing and sitting too close to things, it has to do with, when you hold something close to you, it doesn't hurt your eyes if you're not looking at it, which sounds silly, but like that gets to the point of, like, what is it about looking at screens too close to your eyes that it's bad? The screen close to your eyeballs doesn't shoot out rays that, you know, destroy your eyes, right? They're not shooting UV light out of these screens.
The sun does that.
Eyes. Yeah, exactly. The reason... have looking at a device close to your face is because you're looking at it, and by looking at it you must force your eyes to focus on something that is inches from your face. It is the focusing of your eyes on something that is close to your eyes that is, you know, presumably causing the whatever the myopia that they said comes from this or whatever, right? Again, if your eyes are closed and you hold a phone close to your face, it does not cause myopia because you're not looking at it. Now, when you have the headset, yes, the screens are really close to your eyes, but what are your eyes focusing on? Your eyes are not trying to, hopefully, focus on something that is inches from their face. What they're focusing on is a screen that appears to be 4 feet in front of them. And your eyes don't care that the screens are right there. They just care, where are we focusing? Like, how, and focusing with the eyes, I'm not an eye doctor, but, you know, my understanding of focus is first you've got the convergence point of, like, where are your eyes pointing? They have to be pointing at the thing. And if the thing is close to you, they're pointing, you know, you can go cross-eyed if you take something and push it right up to your nose, right? And if it's really far in the distance, your eyes can be, you know, straight ahead and parallel if you're focusing on infinity, right? And the second thing is the muscles that squish your eye and squish the little parts of your eye. I think they squish the lens. Anyway, there's muscles that are attached to your eye that squish squishy stuff, which is why when you get old, they can't squish it anymore because everything gets hard when you're old.
Yeah.
They're squishing parts of your eyes and those muscles are working. And the closer you're focusing, the more they have to do squishy stuff. And that causes eye strain and so on and so forth. So it's not the fact that the screens that are fractions of an inch from your eye inside the headset, that only matters if you're asking your eyes to focus on something inches from you in the virtual world. You're not looking at the pixels on the screen. You're looking at images on the screen. And I would imagine, I don't know this for sure, but I'm going to say I would imagine that because your eyes think they're focusing 5 feet away, it's the same as if they were focusing on something 5 feet away. So I if they're going to put a myopia warning in Apple Vision Pro, it should be when you drag one of the app rectangles to be 2 inches from your face. Exactly the same way it would be if you take your phone and put it 2 inches from your face. But if those rectangles are out at the end of the coffee table, like they're in the demos, no myopia warning, totally consistent messaging.
What about using it on a plane?
That's the situation we talked about, where if you've traveled on a plane recently and you've been in coach, the seat back in front of you is inches from your face, it feels like, you know, especially if the jerk leans back, right? Not a lot of room. We were like, how is it going to draw the screen, like a virtual screen in sort of, you know, transparency mode or whatever they go, where you can see the rest of the plane around you, but there's just a floating screen in midair where you're watching your TV show, right? But wouldn't that screen like clip through the seat? Wouldn't it be weird that the screen looks like it's 3 feet in front of you, but the seat back is a foot and a half in front of you? Well, in the keynote, they had a video of this, of someone watching a movie on a plane. And as Sage points out, it looks suspiciously roomy. So maybe it's business class. So we still don't know the answer of how this is going to look. How far away can you get the screen from you? What does it do when you want the screen to be farther away from you than the seat back? But Apple has put out a video of showing someone watching it on a plane. So they seem to think it's possible. So first person to get this, please board a plane and try it out.
I think it's Lars, kind of interesting, like their focus on AR first. Like this is an AR first experience, it seems, will kind of require you to have more space to make use of all the virtual real estate, even though that's not like physically necessary. Like if you want to have like a large computing space, it seems like, you know, unless there's other features or other implementation modes that we don't really know about yet, it seems like you have to also be in a large physical space to get a large virtual space.
Well, unless you do that whole put me on Mount Hood, I forget what they called it, but, you know, transport me somewhere else. I've cranked the digital crown all the way in the one direction, so I don't get to see anything of my actual space. I'm living in virtual reality. Like in that case, you have infinite space to play with. But yeah, if you're doing the like I want to be present in the room thing, I think you're exactly right.
I mean, you could turn it halfway so it's just got the Mount Hood around like the front of you, but like in the end, it's not going to stop you from putting a screen where it couldn't physically be. It just will take away from the reality of the situation a little bit, because you'll know there could not be a plane floating in that place because it would be in the middle of that piece of furniture. But tough luck. It's there. I can see it. Like, I don't think it's going to like say, oh, sorry, you can't put it there. I'm going to show you the seat back. Right. I think it's going to show the movie in a quote unquote impossible sort of MC Escher type space just because it can. And that's what you want. And the transparency is just so you don't feel like, oh, someone's going to sneak up on me, or like, I want to be able to see what's going on around me. The same way when you look at a movie on your seat back, you can see in your peripheral vision what's going on, right? That's what they want to reproduce. So you don't feel isolated. You feel like you're still on the plane with the other people who are there, but you're also watching a movie. The movie is just a little bit bigger. Like, that's one of the things they were very careful, A, not to show, and B, not to allow anyone in the press demos to do, because it was a very controlled environment in the press demo. Like, people pointed out, like, you know, at no time did any of the Apple employees, like, go into a place where they weren't expected. Like, they did the thing where they pop in and break through, like they demonstrated that, but it's not like there's people walking back and forth and like a bunch of crap in the room. It's a very controlled environment. If you put one of these things on and went outside and walked onto a New York City street, the AR experience is not going to be able to keep up, because we know what's in the front of this thing. It's like a LiDAR scanner, there's like IR blasters, right? but they can't handle an outdoor city environment with people everywhere and cars and stuff. So it won't know what the surroundings are like. It'll just do its best. And that's what the first people to get this are going to have to try. Like, some YouTuber is going to strap this thing on and go out for a walk and see, like, what does it make of a walk in the woods? Like, how does it handle it? You know, how does it feel? You know, does it take away from the experience when the floating rectangles are impossible places, or is it just fine? And, you know, as long as the rectangle looks clear, I don't care.
If the guy in front of you leans the seat back on the plane, do all the windows like through. Hit you in the nose? Like, does it like push all the windows forward? Like, there's so many questions.
All right. Lars would like to know, hey, why did they call it Vision Pro? Apple Vision would have been so much more elegant. Do you think they already plan to release a low-cost, non-pro version of the headset? And if so, how would you build that without ruining the entire experience?
Well, yeah, it is called Vision Pro for a reason, but that reason is the non-pro version that they could make now would be unacceptable by Apple standards, right? What they're releasing, I feel like, is the minimum spec of one of these things they will ever release. But it is expensive right now. They will come out with a non-pro one, but only when the non-pro one can be way cheaper than this one and equal or better specs. Maybe it will be literally this one, and they'll just repackage it kind of like iPhone style, where they take old iPhones, they repackage them or whatever, right? But putting Pro on the name, it's a signifier of the price. It shows that this is the high-end one, but this is the minimum they would put out. Like, I don't think you will ever see a headset that has appreciably lower specs than this ever from Apple, because I feel like this is like the original iPhone on the ragged edge of what's possible and acceptable, and it will only get better from here. And there will have to be one or two more generations of this before we get a non-pro, I feel like.
I think also it's part of the marketing expectation setting that, look, this is an expensive device. We not only is this a high-priced device, but we are acknowledging that it is high-priced, and we are acknowledging this is high-end. And it kind of gives them it kind of disclaims to the world, this is not our answer on pricing for this category. This is not like the final word here. This is going to be our first thing. It's a big thing. We know it's expensive, and it's aimed at a high-end market. And then that kind of gives them room later to come in with something, you know, lesser. And it sets expectations to the world. They don't think $3,500 is a mass market consumer level price for this device long term. This is just what they have now.
All right. Tell me about Vision Pro in gaming.
This is a point that we didn't talk about last time, and we should have. Gaming. We'll talk more about gaming on the Apple platforms in a little bit. But you know, Apple didn't lean very heavily into gaming on this. But I think a lot of people who are into VR gaming, you know, the PC, you know, playing Windows games in VR, would see this product and they would want it because the screens are amazing, right? It looks cool. The screens are amazing. The transparency effect is something a lot of gaming headsets don't have at all or not even close to this quality, right? So people would want this hardware. But this product, and I imagine all future headset products that Apple makes, will never be high-end gaming VR headsets for one simple reason, and that is Apple seems to think this should be a standalone device. It does not connect to anything. It doesn't even tether to your phone. High-end gaming headsets connect to a gigantic 500-watt multi-fan blowing water-cooled PC in a tower thing under your desk. And as technology marches on, the gigantic tower that draws 500 watts and is water-cooled will always have more computing power than the battery-powered thing that you put on your face. So that means the high-end, those people who like high-end VR gaming, they're like, I can't wait, I'm going to get one of these Vision Pro things. Yeah, eventually the Vision Pro will have the power of today's tower computer, but by then the tower computers will have gotten faster too. And so Apple has essentially taking itself out of the highest of the high end of VR gaming with their design of this product by saying it must be standalone. And based on what they've shown and what you're using it for, that's the right choice, because that's not what this device is about. It's not like you're going to be able to play the most advanced 3D games. If they were doing that, they would have to have the hand controls and everything, right? They're not interested in that market. And standalone is way more important for them to do that, right? So that is important to point out. And if you're wondering, well, this thing seems pretty powerful, you can run pretty good games on it, remember that the R1 chip has its own job. It's basically doing all the sensor fusion and all that. Like, it is busy. So that leaves the M2 to do everything else. What kind of high-end games can you run on an M2? Not an M2 Pro, not an M2 Max, not an M2 Ultra, a plain M2. That is the sort of power class of you know, CPU GPU combo that is going to be in a standalone headset. And yes, it will advance with time. But just think of, you know, think of your favorite game and think of how well it runs on an M2 MacBook Air. Yeah, you can play lots of cool games and they look really good. But the highest of the high-end game, these PC gamers who like have overclocking their giant water-cooled things to get the most frame rates out of the most demanding games, they want this device because the screens are amazing, but they don't want this device because it does not have the GPU power. And there is no, you know, like kind of like the HomePod, there is no input where you can say, all right, Apple Vision Pro, just forget about what you're doing, but just can you just be an awesome screen for my gaming PC? And the answer to that is no.
Well, just look at your PlayStation and it'll project the screen into the into yeah. Vision OS.
When Apple buys Sony, maybe that'll happen.
No, my word. And then allegedly there are some options with regard to writing code for the Vision Pro. There's a work with Apple page. I forget where it is, but we'll link it in the show notes. And it has three options: Apple Vision Pro compatibility evaluations. If you currently have an iPad or iPhone app in the App Store, we can help you test it on Apple Vision Pro. Request a compatibility evaluation from App Review to get a report on your app or game's appearance and how it behaves in Vision OS. Apple Vision Pro Developer Labs. Apply for the opportunity to attend an Apple Vision Pro Developer Lab where you can experience your Vision OS, iPadOS, and iOS games running on Apple Vision Pro. With direct support from Apple, you'll be able to test and optimize your apps and games, so they'll be ready when Apple Vision Pro is available to customers. Labs will be available in 6 locations worldwide: Cupertino, London, Munich, Shanghai, Singapore, and Tokyo. And then finally, and this is what we were all wondering about, Apple Vision Pro Developer Kit. To support great ideas for apps and games for Vision OS, developer kits will be available to help bring your creations to life on Apple Vision Pro. These kits will provide the ability to quickly build, iterate, and test on Apple Vision Pro, so your app or game will be ready to deliver amazing experiences. Stay tuned for how to apply.
So this sounds really cool and theoretically great. We don't know a lot of the details yet, you know? So first of all, like, you know, it's probably going to be, this is probably an order in which you have to do the operations. Like, I'm guessing it's like, use the SDK with the simulator that is coming out, I believe they said later this month, so later in June sometime. Use the SDK to build something in the simulator first. You know, see if it works. You know, the simulator has a decent amount of capability from what it seems from the videos and stuff. And, you know, so try it there first. Then submit this ticket to Apple saying, hey, can you see if my app works okay on the real hardware? And then maybe they'll say, hey, you know what? This app looks pretty cool. You know, let's offer more stuff. Let's offer a lab or maybe a developer kit. That's how I'm guessing this is going to go. It's possible that I'm wrong, and it's possible that like almost anybody can get a developer kit if they try to. But given the level of excitement and hopefully secrecy around this platform, and given how incomplete the software still is, I'm guessing they're going to be very careful giving those out. First of all, I'm guessing that it will not have like any other software to run and might lack many of the capabilities of a final shipping device. Like, you know, maybe it won't have any of the eye stuff, like where it shows the eyes on the outside. Maybe it won't be able to like make FaceTime calls or whatever. Like, I'm guessing those dev kits are going to be very limited, and of course they're going to be NDA'd like crazy. So, because I can't imagine Apple being very willing to risk like some YouTuber getting a dev kit and doing a review of it, in November or whatever, you know, months before this thing is going to ship. That seems very unlikely to be allowed or to be enabled by them. So I'm guessing they are going to be hard to get and limited and certainly NDA'd like crazy.
I think the only place where you got that order of operations wrong is that if you are a company that Apple really wants to make Vision Pro apps and you haven't done the compatibility evaluation and you haven't gone to the developer labs, Apple's still going to come knock on your door and say, hey, you should take one of these. Do you want one? I know you haven't come to our labs and you haven't asked us to evaluate anything, but we really love to see what you can do with it. And that's, you know, the big important companies that Apple wants to be on the platform, they will proactively offer. But everybody else, yeah, it's going to be difficult to get one of these, I imagine.
Yeah, and again, like if you were hoping to get a dev kit to like have the early experience of what this thing is like just in usage, it would not surprise me if you can't do much with the dev kit except run your own app. So I wouldn't hold your breath on that.
All right, John, this is your favorite part of your favorite episode. Let's talk about follow-up for Max.
We've got the MacBook Air 15-inch. A couple of more details have come out about that. So first is the base model 15-inch. I mean, we could have looked this up on Monday, but we didn't. The base model 15-inch has all the GPU cores enabled, which is different than the base model 13-inch because you can get a binned one that only has 8 working GPU cores out of the 10. And so that means that all cores working 13-inch is within $100 of the 15-inch. This is all just making the 15-inch look like an even better deal, right? You know, the quote-unquote $200 price difference from, you know, $10.99 to $12.99, it's actually really just a $100 price difference because all the 15 inches have all working parts in their SoCs. That's great. The base model 15-inch comes with the 35-watt dual-port charger as a no-cost option. Oh, no, with a no-cost option to get the 70-watt charger, whereas the base 13-inch comes with the cruddy 30-watt single-port charger, and you have to, like, pay to upgrade to the better chargers. So that's another plus. The 15-inch for merely $100 more than an equivalent 13-inch comes with your choice of two better chargers at no additional cost. So loving the 15-inch. And also, I just recently saw a teardown of the 15-inch, and the insides of it look like Apple has done put a little bit more effort into cooling. I know it's weird because it's fanless, just like the 13-inch, but like the 13-inch had the barest of amount of material slapped onto the top of the SoC, and now it looks like a little bit thicker, kind of, you know, metally tapey parts are on there. We'll see when people start testing these for temperature or whatever, but I'm loving the 15-inch.
Yeah, I actually went to the local Apple store today just to very briefly hold the 13-inch Air and the 15-inch Air, and when I first picked it up, I was like, wow, this is heavier than I expected, but actually, I think that was not the correct reaction, to truth be told. It actually is not very much heavier than the 13. It does look ever so slightly wonky not having speaker grills on either side of the keyboard, but I don't find it nearly as bothersome as most people seem to. But it looks really nice. Like, I mean, I only played with it for literally 2 or 3 minutes, but even though I am not in the market for a large laptop, and certainly I would get a MacBook Pro for several different reasons, but yeah, if you're interested in a big screened but otherwise not bananas laptop, you know, something that's aimed more for a regular human and not, you know, somebody like the three of us, then it's a really good deal. And it seems like a really nice computer. Everyone who's had a press model or whatever, a test model, says that it's basically exactly like 13, but bigger. And pretty much anyone who has a 13-inch MacBook Air says it's the best computer Apple's made in years. So yeah, this is 2 thumbs up for me, even, I mean, based on my very limited usage.
And as Marco would say, they didn't half butt this. Like in the teardown, the motherboard, it's not the 13-inch motherboard just shoved into a 15-inch case. It's a different motherboard. It's smaller than the 13-inch motherboard because they had to have room for the speakers or whatever. And if you look at like the differences between the 13 and the 15, there's like more bracing and more metal and more screws in the 15 to keep it from flexing because it's bigger. Like it's a typical Apple laptop where they thought it out. It's not just like, oh, we'll take the guts of the 13-inch, shove it into a 15-inch thing and put in some bigger batteries. It's a fully designed computer.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk about the Mac Studio. And apparently there's good news in the noise department.
Yes. The M1 Mac Studio had a bad reputation for making more fan noise than we all thought it should. Not that it was super loud, but because it was using in all cases except one, the exact same SoCs that Apple had in laptops, and the laptops were silent, it felt like the Mac Studio should be sound as well, and it wasn't. So here are some measurements straight from Apple. We put links in the show notes to Apple's own specs for both idle and, quote, wireless web usage. The 2022 Mac Studio with an M1 in it, Apple measures it at 15 decibels for both of those things. The 2023 Mac Studio, 6 decibels, which, because of the way decibels work, a 9 dB difference equals 8 times quieter because it's a logarithmic scale. So
that is a lot quieter.
A big improvement. And Jason Snell says, I'm happy to report that Apple has rejiggered the cooling system in the Mac Studio. I could only hear the fan blowing when I turned the Mac Studio around, so that it's vents reporting right at me. And even then, it was pretty quiet. When I properly oriented the computer on my desk, I couldn't hear the fan. I placed my M1 Mac Studio on a nearby table, and I could still hear it blowing. I wouldn't call the M2 Mac Studio silent, but it's noticeably quieter than the M1 model. And if you were to keep it on top of your desk, you probably wouldn't hear it. Good news. Apple should have touted this, but then again, if they touted this, it would have been like admitting the M1 had a cooling problem. Love to hear it. Love to hear they fix this. This is not a small change. Good job, Apple.
Yeah, this indeed. Is because, again, that was always such a baffling flaw in the first one, because it seemed like the first Mac Studio was such a great computer in so many other ways, like every other way. And then it had this weird, unnecessary flaw. So now this is great because now we can just, you know, there's no more like gotcha about the Mac Studio. Now it's just like, yeah, if this product works for you, buy it. No questions asked.
Yeah, the only remaining, it's not a gotcha, but the only remaining thing holding back the Mac Studio is the fact that the fans are low diameter. So while that doesn't affect the number of decibels, it affects the frequency, right? And sometimes the higher frequency, smaller fans, higher frequency noise can be more annoying at exactly the same level than lower frequency, which is why if you want a silent PC, you get gigantic fans like they're in my Mac Pro. Huge improvement. Like the size of the fans, it's a small case, right? The fans kind of have to be small. They could do way better cooling, as I said with the when we looked at the M1 one, way better cooling if they did front to back airflow. They don't. They do bottom to back airflow. The air on the Mac Studio comes in the bottom and goes out the top of the back. So we'll see if they ever redesign that case. But big improvement year over year. And it's not just Jason got like a blessed perfect press model, because like I said, these are links from Apple's own spec pages saying what they measure the sound to be. And I feel like Apple's probably being honest with themselves.
One would hope. All righty. There's good news in the fan department, but some very questionable news with regard to pricing. The pricing seems a little wonky. What's going on there?
We talk about this all the time with Apple's upgrade prices being disconnected from reality. But even within the weird anti-reality of Apple's pricing scheme, their own, options prices in the Porsche style have bumped up against each other. So Sloan Studio pointed this out. A Mac Mini with an M2 Pro and a 19-core GPU, 32 gigs of RAM, 1 terabyte SSD is the same price as a Mac Studio with M2 Max, a 30-core GPU in the same RAM and SSD. With the Studio, you get 10 gigabit Ethernet, 2 more USB-C ports, an SD card reader, and 11 more GPU cores with exactly the same price. That's a problem. when things are literally exactly the same price, one should not be that much better. And remember, this is a mini compared to a Studio. It's not two different classes of machine. It's not laptop versus desktop. It's literally a mini and a taller mini. And the taller mini with way more stuff in it is exactly the same price because of the ridiculous cost of add-ons.
Indeed. All right, tell me about John Ternus on the talk show and discrete GPUs.
I'll put a link in the show notes to a YouTube clip. This is a feature that YouTube's added recently where you can take any YouTube video that you're watching and save a clip, which just saves two offsets on it, start at this time, end at this time, kind of like the overcast clip thing. And I love it because, YouTube has always supported time offsets in the URL. You could just put T equals 3M4S for 3 minutes and 4 seconds, but it wouldn't tell it when to end. And the clip thing adds that. So anyway, we'll have a YouTube clip linked in the show notes, which will probably break in 5 years when YouTube sunsets the clip feature. But for now, it will work. Here is the quote from John Ternus when Gruber was asking him about discrete GPUs in Macs. Ternus said, "Fundamentally, we've built our architecture around the shared memory model and that optimization. And so it's not entirely clear to me how you'd bring in another GPU and do so in a way that is optimized for our systems. It just hasn't been a direction we've wanted to pursue." Now, John Ternus is not part of the marketing department, but like all the Apple executives, he is, press trained, media trained, as they call it. So it's hard to say whether this answer tells you anything. Because if Phil Schiller said it, I would say, well, there's no information in this statement, because he's so well-trained that when he says something like this, he's not making any statement about future products. But when I see someone closer to the engineering side say something like this, when he says, it hasn't been a direction that we wanted to pursue, now that's past tense, right? But when he says, it's not entirely clear to me how you bring in another GPU and do it in a way that was optimized, if there was systems in Apple's labs that they had developed and decided not to ship, or that they were planning on developing that quote unquote brought in another GPU, I don't think he would have phrased it that particular way. So, take it. These are his words. Take it as you will. It technically doesn't say anything about future products. But when I heard him say that, it made me think they're not really interested in discrete GPUs at all now, in the past, or in the near future. We'll see.
Yeah, I wouldn't hold your breath on that. The way I interpreted that was basically, this does not fit into the direction we've chosen to go, and that's, and they're not going to change their direction, especially just for this one, edge case product. It seems like the Mac Pro was made for people in recording studios. Basically, this is like a recording studio or video editing studio kind of product where people have a lot of cards for like audio or video I/O. and that's it. Like, it seems like that's the main.
Well,
and you know,
we'll get to that in a little bit, because even in that application, there's problems.
Yes, yes. but yeah, it seems like the Mac Pro, you know, as we discussed last week, this is a product that looks like it's designed to kill the Mac Pro. But it at least is going to keep it a marginalized product. It's not going to expand its market. It's going to lose some of its market. But we also don't know, you know, as outsiders, how many people have actually been buying the Mac Pro and using graphics card expansion. Like, besides you, and I don't think anyone else is doing what you do with it, like, to basically buy a Mac Pro to be a gaming PC.
Well, I mean, one thing to gauge it by is Apple has released a bunch of new video cards for this. And they almost never, like, you know, the Mac Pro way of doing things is you release a product and you don't touch it for 5 years. But over the course of those 5 years, they've been steadily releasing new graphics cards. Someone's got to be buying them, otherwise why would they keep making them, right?
I guess so. That's fair. But right? I would guess that, like, you know, they looked at the market and they're like, all right, well, we sell this many Mac Pros. You know, this percentage of them adds PCI cards for, you know, audio and video I/O, and then this other percentage of them adds GPUs. And, you know, given our new architecture, is it really worth serving that, you know, sub market of a sub market that adds GPUs to their Mac Pro? And they clearly decided not to. And it's not to say they never will, but I think that whatever factors led them to make that decision for this product, those factors are going to continue to be the case in the future, or even become more, you know, extreme.
We'll see about that. But that's what this statement is weird, because, like, Apple makes all sorts of stuff internally that never sees the light of day. I know for a semi-fact firsthand all sorts of things that Apple has done internally that they decided not to ship for, you know, mostly good reasons. But, like, if you know, they experiment, like, what about this? What about that? Right? And not they make a fully formed product, but they're like, if we made a product like this, does this make sense? Do we have the parts? Can we put it together? Can we prototype it? What do you think of it? Right? The fact that he said it's not entirely clear to me how you'd bring in another GPU and do so in a way that is optimized can be read multiple ways. You could say, well, we did make a thing with another GPU and we couldn't figure out how to integrate it in the system in a way that made sense. Like, we got it to work. You know, for people wondering, it's not impossible to connect another GPU to these things. You could do it. It's just like, well, then what about the GPU that's on there and how do we integrate them and is it useful and does it work well? Right. He could be saying that. We could be saying we never tried that because that's not the path that we're pursuing. We didn't even prototype it. We just set it aside. I don't know any of these things. I don't have any inside info of what they tried with respect to this particular thing. But a statement like this doesn't really close the door on, oh, yeah, we tried it, but it was crappy. Like, it wasn't good. It wasn't worth it. Nobody would want it. And we think we can do better without it. And we'll see how it goes. But speaking of doing better without it, let's assess how they've done here. If we look at, now we've got metal scores, you know, Geekbench scores for all this stuff. So look at the metal scores. This is like a benchmark of Apple's graphics API. So you basically only see Apple stuff here because it's Apple's API. And we're talking about the M2 Ultra here. And the M2 Ultra, remember, is in the Mac Studio, but it's also the exact same thing in the Mac Pro. As far as you know, they're not clocked differently. There's no, it's the same SoC in both places. So when I say M2 Ultra, you can think Mac Pro in your head, but you can also think Mac Studio. With the metal scores, the M1 Max SoC was around 108K. The M1 Ultra was around 150K. So that's a 1.3 times the M1 Max performance. But the M1 Ultra had two times the GPU cores as the M1 Max. The M1 Ultra is two M1 Maxes stuck together. So if it has twice the GPU cores, why is it only 1.3 times faster in a GPU benchmark? GPUs usually scale linearly. And the answer to that is something I think we touched on ages ago when we were talking about the M1 Ultra. That there's some, I forget the details now, but there's some limitation in the M1 Ultra that doesn't let it scale its GPU cores linearly. I don't know if it's like some cache or translation buffer or something that wasn't big enough. And that's kind of a shame, because you did get twice the GPU cores, but you didn't get twice the performance. You only got 1.3 times the performance, and that was crappy. All right, so now we've got the M2 Max, which is 130K, which is 1.2 times as fast as the M1 Max for 1.2 times the GPU cores. So that's linear as well. Now the M2 Ultra. The M2 Ultra is twice as fast as the M2 Max for twice as many GPU scores. Yay for linear GPU scaling. And that means the M2 Ultra is 267K, which is a respectable metal score. The M2 Ultra is now the fifth fastest metal score overall on the Geekbench charts. The top three scores on the metal charts are the 2019 Mac Pro with graphics cards in it. So... good showing for the M2 Ultra. Linear scaling, awesome. And by the way, if you're wondering like, oh, should I bother getting the M2 Ultra? The M1 Ultra was not as good a deal if you care about GPU cores. The M2 Ultra, it's linear. It's got twice as much as the M2 Max, and it does twice the performance on GPU. So it's doing great. It's doing exactly what we wanted. But here's the thing. The M2 Ultra is two M2 Maxes. The M2 Ultra is not four M2 Maxes, which is what we were hoping for, right? So two M2 Maxes, the M2 Ultra, that's an amazing SoC for a tall Mac Mini, right? You know, it's the fifth fastest ever, right? It is not an amazing SoC for a gigantic tower computer, okay? So here is the M2 Ultra versus NVIDIA. And this is not like Metal Performance Scores or OpenCL or whatever. This is running a graphics benchmark. This is the GFXbenchmark.com. I'll put a link in the show notes. This is running their Aztec Ruins high tier benchmark, right? We're looking at frame rates because like, well, forget about what the metal score is, forget about this, but like frame rates, right? An NVIDIA 4080 has 16% higher frame rate than the M2 Ultra. Yeah, you know, the M2 Ultra is in spitting distance of the 4080, not bad. The 4090 has 37% higher frames per second. And the 4090, remember, is a card that launched 8 months ago. So the 4090 is still kind of pooping all over the M2 Ultra, which is you would expect, but it's kind of a shame, right? And this is, you know, putting it in perspective, Apple does not have a computer with a competitive, with any GPU that's competitive with a single one of the 8-month-old king of the PC GPUs.
And for whatever it's worth, the 4090 also currently costs about $1,600, and God still knows how much,
you know, how much does a Mac Pro cost though?
It's fair, but like, you know, also how much power does this thing draw? I mean,
yeah, well, that this is for, it was for the Mac Pro, right? So, you know, the M2 Studio, the M2 Ultra Mac Studio, great, awesome, no complaints, really good performance, scales linearly, it's in a tiny little case, it's quiet, love it, thumbs up. The gigantic Mac Pro has the same exact SoC, and this is what I'm always talking about is like Apple with this generation of Macs, Apple is seeding the high end. We're talking about GPU, you know, seeding the high end of GPUs to the rest of the world. Apple does not have anything that is in the conversation with the best PC GPUs. And in the past, when they've had horrendously expensive Mac Pros like the one I bought, you could buy them with a video card that would A, cost you way more than $1,600. Like I think the video card that I have in mind now was like $2,800 from Apple originally. Ugh. And it's way slower than a 4090. Way slower, right? But anyway, they're not in the conversation anymore with high-end GPU. Setting aside that you can put multiples into like the 2019 Mac Pro if you need them for computer or whatever, setting that aside, just for on a single GPU basis, the 4090 crushes the M2 Ultra, as you would expect. That's the reason when we discussed this on the back of the envelope years ago, we were like, the quad would be in the conversation. If it was basically, you know, four M2 Maxes or you know, two M2 Ultras, then you'd be in the conversation. But they didn't ship that. So we've just got this. So just to be clear, what about non-game GPU performance? This is an article of someone crapping on the Mac Pro from some PC company or whatever. But anyway, he points out that Apple in the keynote called out the performance of Octane, Redshift, and Blender in the keynote. So he was like, fine, let me look with what the Blender scores are. Blender is a 3D rendering thing, GPU rendering on the M2 Ultra. So the M2 Ultra score is 3,400. The 4090 is 3.8 times faster. The score is 13,000. The 3080 is 1.8 times faster. The 3060, which is a $330 video card, is about the same speed as the M2 Ultra. That's not a good look. Now here's the killer. The 3070 has a score of 3,396 compared to the M2 Ultra's 3,412. That's a laptop GPU. Oh, that hurts. That hurts.
That's deep.
And if you think about it, that laptop is probably noisier than a Mac Studio, right? And I'm not saying the M2 Ultra is a laptop SoC. It's an amazing SoC, but it is not a powerhouse. So GPU, Apple is sitting out this generation. They are not in the conversation on high-end GPU power, which Apple, I think, is fine with, and most of their customers are going to be fine with because most of the customers buy laptops, and these things are amazing laptop GPUs. Just fantastic, phenomenal, just amazing. But are they amazing GPUs to put in a gigantic tower computer that costs $7,000? No, they are not. Let's look at the CPU. The M2 Ultra has a CPU, single-core score of 2217, multi-core score of 18735. Pretty good. How does that stack up to Intel and AMD? Again, setting aside the M2 Studio and all the laptops where these chips stomp all over everybody. What about your $7,000 gigantic tower with three humongous fans in it? that, you know, they could have and have in the past put Intel Xeons on there. I've got an Intel Xeon in there. If they were to build this tower today with a modern Intel Xeon, what kind of scores would it be getting? Well, the Intel Xeon W9-3595X, which is a 56-core Xeon, is 2.8 times faster in multi-core than the M2 Ultra. Again, if they had made a quad, they would have beat that, but they didn't. The Intel Core i9-13900KS is 39% faster in single core and 15% faster in multi-core. And those chips, you cannot put those in a Mac Studio, to be clear. Like, that chip is useless for Apple anywhere except for their gigantic tower computer with a huge power supply and tons of cooling. So with this generation of the Mac Pro, Apple is out of the conversation for high-end CPU and high-end GPU entirely. What about PCI Express lanes? In the Xeon generation of the Mac Pro, the 2018 Mac Pro, as far as I've been able to tell, they believe it had 64 Gen 3 PCI lanes. Now, Gen 3 lanes are half the speed of Gen 4 lanes, which was the new Mac Pro has. But even taking that into account, the new Mac Pro has more the old Mac Pro has more PCI Express bandwidth than the new one, because the new one only has 24 lanes. Oh, no, only has, yeah, 24 Gen 4 lanes. And the old one had 40 lanes connected to the CPU and 24 lanes connected to the I/O controller. Hector Martin on Mastodon pointed out that the M2 Ultra basically just has two internal PCIe switches with all these lanes hanging off of them. So even though they have all these slots, they're shared bandwidth because they go through these PCI Express switches. So the M2 Ultra also doesn't have the PCI lane capacity that the Xeon did. It's kind of a shame. Now, finally, we go to Neil Parfit, who is a YouTuber who talks about his use of the Mac Pro in his audio application. And he stuffs it full of cards doing audio stuff. So he seems like the ideal audience of the new Mac Pro. And here's what he had to say in the video. We'll link in the show notes. His current rig is 28-core Xeon 2019 Mac Pro with 768 gigs of RAM. And his problem with the new Mac Pro is when he just launches all his apps and starts working on a project, He's around 300 gigs of RAM usage. But the M2 Ultra Mac Pro, max RAM is 192 gigs. So him just starting up all his projects and launching into all his editors and editing his big composition with all the samples and everything, he's already pushing into swap. That's not great. And his old Mac Pro had 4 16x PCI Express lanes, and the new one only has 2, blah, blah, blah. Probably doesn't matter for audio, but he did note it. The other thing he pointed out was that he kind of thinks that for his particular usage, having a tower version of this is useless because his is always going to be in a rack mount because it's just so noisy and it's got all the cards and the cards have their own fans in them and he's just stuffed to the gills and it's a rack mount, you know, type of thing. Like, it's out of sight, out of mind, shoved off into the side somewhere. So this new Mac Pro, it's probably good for some people's somewhere, but it is an extremely compromised, in every aspect, it is extremely compromised. It is not competitive with the high end of the PC world in any category. PCI Express lanes, GPU speed, CPU speed, and it's a gigantic tower computer. That's, you know, like Marco said, if you wanted to kill the Mac Pro, this is the type of machine you might put out. It's not the end of the story. They may make a quad in the future. Maybe they couldn't pull it off now. Maybe the M3 will change the equation because it'll be on a different process size. But for right now, the takeaway is M2 Ultra is an amazing SoC that is not compromised like the M1 Ultra was. The M2 Ultra Mac Studio is an amazing machine that's quieter than it used to be. And the M2 Ultra Mac Pro is a machine for I don't know who.